Hello, my name is Sean. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to all you who picked up chips, and thank you for asking me to speak, Lindsay. And thank you as well for the 15-minute lead. I kind of wish I was the lead speaker because you don't have to think about it. They kind of like Shanghai you out in the parking lot. And all day I've been like paralyzed at work. I'm like, people are talking to me. I'm like, what'd you say? Because I'm thinking about tonight. I'm all like anxious. It's like 2 p.m. and I'm already freaking out about tonight. And but the 15 minutes, they kind of like, they like speaker snipers. They're like, you, and you're in. You don't have to think about it. You just got to do it, you know? But it's pretty cool because, let's face it, I mean, I wouldn't volunteer to come up here unless someone says, hey, listen, will you do this? Or, hey, you know, you're up. You know, it's kind of, they do it here. And which is cool, though. I think that I have to be told to do those things. But this is a great meeting. I've been coming here ever since I got sober. There's a few meetings that I've been to regularly. And this is one of them, and my sponsor dragged me here. I went to treatment, and treatment has all the meetings they take you to. They go to NA, AA, speaker, you know, all these different types of meetings to see what you like, you know. And but I came to a point where I got to be like a grown-up in treatment, and you can leave, you know. So you have to get a note from your sponsor. And my sponsor is Rod. Many of you know him. He kind of grew up in this actual home group. And he would come kidnap me, and Rod's a maniac. I love him to death. And he's chilled out a lot, but he used to pick me up, like, with these Red Bulls or Monsters. And Rod, he's always double-fisted, not anymore. But, like, he had, like, 48-ounce cans. Like, they weren't even made yet. I was like, Rod, where'd you get these things from? He's like, don't worry about it. He's like, we're going to get you cigarettes. We're going to the meeting. You know, and I was so excited because I was leaving treatment. I was like, yeah, I'm going out. There's girls there. You know, and I'd have this drink, and I'd drink, like, a third of it, and I'd have a flat-out, like, anxiety attack. And I'd be like, man, I ain't going to the meeting. Screw that. You know, and but I couldn't wait till the next time to open up my big 40-ounce drink, you know, and then I finished like a third of them. And that's how it all started. The first time I got, when I kept coming to this meeting, it was back at the old place. I'll tell the story because it actually happened here. But I was like 60 days sober. I was out of treatment and I came here, and they asked me to do How It Works, to read it. It's like no big deal. Like, I didn't really do many readings. You know, I did a couple in treatment and like blew a lid. Like, I was at one meeting and I found, I didn't know they had backs to these, so I read it. I'm like, cool, I'm like sweating. It looks like I swam there. And I found out there was a back to it, and I was like freaking out. So I was like getting myself pumped up for this one. I was like, okay, you can do it. And by this time, I knew a few of you here, because Rod's like introducing me to people, trying to get me to be part of, you know. And so I'm like pumping myself. I got like this 6-foot coffee from Starbucks, you know. I'm like, yeah, you know, which is ridiculous, because what we do in AA is try to be relaxed, calm, you know, and the first thing we do is go to Starbucks and get like a 64-ounce coffee, you know. So I was up there. I was like, okay, you can do it. So I'm up here, right, and I was a little heavier at the time, actually pretty similar to where I am now. I've gained a little bit of weight recently, but and I had these little udders, and I start shaking up here like this, and the podium was much wider than, so you couldn't see, but my legs were shaking, and I'm looking at Nunu. Nunu was over there in the corner. He was my pigeon brother at the time, and I'm like, oh, God. And it was all I could do to get through this thing, and I could feel myself shaking all over, and it was terrible. And I went back to my seat, and I was like, God, why would you do that? You know? Which is huge, because to be honest with you, I've never even talked to God until that moment, really. In treatment, I prayed, but, like, that's a big deal. If I'm actually yelling at God, it means I believe, you know? And after that meeting, I was freaking out. So I was asking people, because I wanted to look good. I didn't look good. You know, I remember Stephen spoke there. That's all I remember. You remember these things because it was so traumatic. It's like a stage 5 anxiety attack. You know what I mean? And now it's no big deal. But I was asking people, like, hey, man, did you see me up there? Was that all right? They're like, oh, yeah, you're fine. You know, no one pays attention, you know? And then the next person was like, dude, you were fine. You nailed it, you know? And I asked Esther. I knew Esther at the time. She told me I looked like a round Matthew McConaughey. So I was like, Esther, do you see that out there? She goes, that was hilarious. And I was like, oh, my God. I was like, Rob, we got to go. I was like, I'm never coming back to this meeting again. And I guess after a while, you kind of get comfortable with being uncomfortable. You know, I don't really, it's not my favorite thing to do up here, but it always feels good. And if I can always help someone, then that's the point of it all. And that's what I had to remind myself today. But it's good stuff. My drinking at an early age, I don't remember my first drink. A lot of people do. I always try to think about it, but I always remember being, I think it was in a fort. We built forts. I lived in the woods, you know, like small town, nothing to do. We built forts, right? And we had like this little thing where we had like nudie mags, and like we'd pick up cigarettes on the side of the road and smoke them. Like, it was a deviant path from the get-go. You know, I should have known this was going to happen. And it was probably like a Seagram's peach. Like, it wasn't Goldschlager. You're making me look like a sissy, you know. But I'm sure that's how it happened. I'm sure I'll have jokes by this later tonight from my friends. But that's how it all happened. And, you know, at first it's like just trying to do it to be cool. I don't know why I thought that was cool, but that was kind of the thing, you know. And but after a while, you know, really a lot of other people started to do it as I turned like 13, 14. And not like really like we end up tearing it up, but, you know, I would do it and I'd come home. And I remember this one time I came home and I had puke all over me. And I was hanging out with people that are like 18. I grew up way too fast. My friends would have short jokes here, but this is a good thing because I'm up here and they can't say anything. It's awesome. But like basically all these people that I hung out with, they would just drop me off. Like they'd hang out with me and I'd leave. And I'd go home to a house where a lot of these people didn't even live with their parents. So they were fine to go home. And I would come home and my mom would be there and I'd be like puke all over me. Well, this one time she opened the door for me. I didn't know this. And she told me the next morning, she's like, yeah, you were drunk last night. And of course, I'm like, absolutely not. You know, and she was like, yeah, you were trying to open the front door with a quarter. And there's puke all over the wall from when I walked up the stairs dragging myself, you know. And of course, I didn't believe her. I'm like, someone must have broken in, Mom. You know, like, and there's just straight up proof right there. And she made me pick up all my change off the front door as well as the key that I couldn't use. And then clean up the puke, you know. But what follows that is how it affects everyone. We take up a lot of space as alcoholics, you know. My one parent's like, hey, what's going on in here? My mom is trying to protect the whole scene so it's not bad. My younger brother, who looks up to me, is in the next room. And the next thing you know, my parents are fighting. I'm still drunk. And my brother next door, who looks up to me, is listening to me telling my mother that I hate her, you know. And those type of things with a little ripple that happens. Here I'm at the age of 13 and 14 and making things like that happen. And, you know, it's not a big deal at that point, I guess. There's adolescence. People do things like that. But when it happens on a consistent basis, at such an early age, and you know as time goes on, that's exactly what happened, those type of instances and things like that. And we really do come through like a tornado, like it says. But the thing is, I would always tell myself I wasn't even drunk. You know, I would do that all the time. Even towards the end, people would be like, hey, listen, you know, I want to talk to you about your drinking. I'd be like, I'm fine. I'm not even that drunk yet. In the early age, I was saying those things. And after a while, we start to believe it. I actually believe that I'm okay, that I'm not even drunk. And it all started, you know, here I am opening the door with a quarter. You know, that's when it all started, and it keeps going and going. And I got to tell you, I had a lot of fun drinking in high school all those times. I mean, that's when there really weren't that many consequences. I mean, the parents you dodged, the teachers, okay, you know, all that sort of thing. But it's not like I was one of those people that like, ooh, I had a Corona. Let's put a certs in. Hope mom doesn't find out. You know what I mean? Like, I'm coming home in like other people's clothes because mine had puke on them. I got like grass stains on me. You know, it's a different type of thing that happens on and on and on. And my poor parents, God bless them, you know. They heard me speak a while back, and all I could do was like, this poor woman sitting right here. She could probably come up here and tell a story better than I could. I could sit in the front row and like deny everything like the good old days. But she actually sat here and listened to it. She goes to Al-Anon, things like that. So we're all on a cool page now. But went like that as a teenager. But I had all types of consequences. I understand about the grades. Mine were terrible in high school because I didn't care about school. I cared about things that were fun. Well, drinking was fun. And I also played sports. I cared about those things. And basically anything I was good at, I promise you, I'll sit up here tonight and tell you that I'm good at drinking. I'll say it 3 or 4 times, which is absolutely ludicrous after you hear my story. But I could hang at parties. I would never try to outdrink any of you guys. But anyone else at those parties, you'd be like, I will crush you right now. Let's do it. And that became like my identity. I could go to these parties and do this, and it meant jumping off a building. I would do that, whatever it took to get your approval and become this person that, dude, you want that guy around. He's out of his tree. And I would do those things. And the consequences, I mean, would come, but the school, and I missed out on a lot of things. I missed out on what normal people do at that age, whether it's just going to hang out at a friend's house, reading books. I don't even know what people do, go bowling. You know, I mean, things like that. And I was at the game the other night. I went to see USF at Rutgers, and my stepdad, I went with him, and he's a Rutgers alumni. So we all met with their alumni group, and they're all decked out in red, and they're like, yeah, man, Rutgers, class of 72. You know, I'm sitting there like, phew. And they're like, so, did you go to Rutgers? I was like, no. They're like, where'd you go? I was like, well, I went to 7 colleges. You know, and I had no answer. I was like, FIU, I just told him the last college I went to, because I really did go to seven colleges. But the point of that was, I went in the game later on, and I'm watching the USF students, and they have the band going, which is a pretty good feel-good situation, you know? And I remember sitting there, I got sad. I was like, man, I was like, I never had any of that. You know, not in high school, I didn't enjoy the football games with the band, the colleges, I didn't have something to rally around. And, you know, believe it or not, out of the seven colleges I went to, granted, none of them really had a large tradition. It's not like I went to University of Michigan where that was something big you would embrace. But, you know, even if I went to that school or Florida or some school with a huge tradition where that's a big deal, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. I know it. I would maybe make it to the game, maybe get kicked out in the parking lot, or even get to the game and not even care. You know, just watch football. I just wouldn't care about something. I don't appreciate it. And I got kind of sad at the game, and it was cool because I have all those things now. You know, I get to do these cheesy things like bowling. We go out movies. Sometimes I do movies. I'm not a good movie person. I'm a damaged alcoholic. Like, I'll tell you why. People always ask me to go to movies, and I'm like, well, how long is that? I got the attention span of like a goldfish, you know, and I'm very anxious. And that's my first question. Not is it good? And it has to be like, I can't watch Forrest Gump. Joseph, my friend, he's bought me 3 Forrest Gump. Every year for my birthday, he buys me a Forrest Gump DVD. That's his deal. Until I actually watch it, he's going to keep buying them. And I can't watch it because every 10 minutes I cry. And I'm like, screw this. I'm sitting there crying. Like, why would I want to do this? They're like, ooh, it's a feel-good movie. I don't feel good when I'm crying. Like, you know what I mean? It's seriously. And long movies, like suspense movies, I can do suspense movies if they're not too long. Like, if you drag something out way too long, I'm going to have a full-blown anxiety attack. Like, I need closure. Like, this is good, but something needs to happen quick. You know? And I get so anxious in there. My poor girlfriend, it's a challenge to pick movies. I always want funny movies because I want to feel good. And let's face it, the humor movies, the comedies out there, they're not that funny. They're terrible. You know, I'll be sitting there watching a comedy. I'm like, come on, get funny. I'll laugh at something. I'll be like, it's not even funny. I'm like, come on. I want to laugh, you know? And she's like, really? We can't do this. She's online, like, you know? So there's a lot of things I get to do now, but there's some things that are challenging because I'm a damaged emotional alcoholic, I guess. But I had the legal consequences. My first legal thing was a drunk in public, and I had I played a lot of soccer growing up, and I was on crutches. I had a surgery at the time. And I had just turned 18, which sucks because it made me legal to make the newspaper. It was like a week after. And these cops bust a home party. You know how it is. A small town. Just people open up a house and go to town. And so I'm on crutches, and everyone else is running. I can't run. I'm like hobbling, you know. And the cop's like, you. Like, what am I going to do? Run? I can't do anything. So I got busted, taken to jail. And the next morning, this was not good because both my parents were school teachers. And I grew up in a small town where they had the stupid newspapers are like 7 pages long, like local pizzeria sponsors, baseball team, stupid stuff, you know. And I was kind of known in the town as a soccer player, whatever. And so they put on my article, they gave my full name. It's like local soccer star, Shawn Michael, whatever, found frothing at the mouth. And that's what it said in the newspaper. And I was like, oh, my God, my poor parents. That's the only thing I could think about. Because they were both school teachers in the system. And that's where really an alcoholic doesn't even care about us. I just accrued my first charge. Doesn't matter at all to me, you know, but I'm worried about how it affects other people. And we kind of lose after a while. I lost that. This is where I'm holding. This is the path I'm going down, and that's it. My grades are poor. I've now got a record. My parents were always those people who say, if you get a record, you're never going to get a job, which is a load of it, you know. And they just wanted me to be okay. You know, they didn't want me to go down that path. Well, it happened. You know, and all those type of consequences would just continue out through my colleges, careers. I went to school in D.C., the Blue Ridge Mountains, Miami, Fort Lauderdale. I did all those things because I was playing soccer at the time, and my grades were so poor. This was the most important thing in my life at the time was soccer, because it's the one thing I had a passion for. I enjoyed drinking. I enjoyed the fun of it, and the whole wildness that went with it. It wasn't really just the first drink at that point. It was the letting loose, the kind of the being free or whatever it is that went along with it. And the only other way I got that feeling, which was much more genuine, was when I actually played soccer. And And after school, I would go just train and train, and I was on several teams traveling. I got to play through Europe, and my grades were so poor, I couldn't go to a good college where I actually wanted to play. So I played with a couple of apprenticeship teams and played minor league soccer and things like that. But that's why I became so transient wherever I played, that they would pay for classes, and that's how I ended up being like a little gypsy. But that was the only thing that I actually cared about, and drinking eventually took that away from me. You know, the one thing I had a passion for, and I had a couple soccer injuries and I could no longer play at a competitive level. They're like, listen, this isn't going to happen anymore. You can try to suit up maybe later on down the road, but you're going to be out of commission for a while. And I was like, that's fine. Because deep down inside, I always wanted a normal life. Let's face it, going to 7 different colleges in like 5 years, not very normal. You know, and I was telling myself, going here and going here, which was great because I was good at meeting people. But I was terrible at being a friend, and that came along with me taking what I wanted from you and then leaving. I would leave you in my past. I would get people's phone numbers, of course, you do everything like that, but I couldn't stay in touch with anyone, more or less my family or anyone that I met. You know, and going through those times, I kind of lived a very lonely life that I wanted to settle down. I want to live a 9-to-5 job just like other people do, because I didn't have the same college experience either. Like, you go to a 4-year school, you go to a trade, or you enter the job market. I was all over the place. And I wanted something that was consistent, something that other people had. And I didn't know what it was, and it actually had nothing to do with that. It just had everything to do with I was very comfortable with myself inside. Because eventually I had that 9-to-5 job, and nothing changed. You know, my drinking became less fun. When I would drink at this point, I would lose the power of choice. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. I don't know what's going to happen. There's plenty of people that can drink with impunity that I hung out with, and plenty of people that drink very recklessly. But, you know, that I don't know if they're alcoholics. You know, I know I am, and I know that I went on until God said, listen, enough is enough. And it comes on later in my story. But never once in my life did I, and I mean this, even till the last day where I stopped drinking, did I think about stopping drinking. That's how much this disease had me. All the consequences as I had. And I mean, I got to do a lot of great things aside from the bad things, the consequences. I got to travel through Europe, and all my pictures from Europe just show derelict all over. It's like porn, the red light district in like Amsterdam. It's like coffee shop, bar, porn store. And eventually there'll be like a cathedral in there. Like, you can tell that was like part of the guided tour, like when they had that, you know. And I had this host family when I was in Germany. And I got screwed. I got the worst host family. Everyone else got cool families. In mine, I had this weirdo, the son, who was my age. He would drink and like, he wore fluorescent camo every day, like orange camo. And he would go hang out in graveyards and drink. That's what him and his friends did. And I've done a lot of crazy stuff, but I was like, I'm not going with you guys. So the mother, who kind of took care of me and fed me bread and cheeses and all this stuff, you know, she could speak a little bit of English. But the father was just some blue-collar guy in Germany that never learned English at all. And but he was a straight lush. And here I am. I'm 18 years old. And so I would just stay up drinking all night with this guy, and he doesn't speak any English, and I speak no German, and we would just die laughing all night long, just getting hammered, you know? Here it is, a kid my age, probably relate to him, a person who speaks English, you can relate to him, and the person that's none of that, I love that guy, you know? And we had a blast. Then it happened for 3 or 4 times, and I was there for a huge tournament. And everyone else is waking up like, well, we're going to eat oatmeal and all this, and I'm like, oh, God. You know, they took it serious, and all I could think about was like, this is amazing. I get to drink with no pressure. No one's watching. This guy's helping. You know, it was amazing, you know, and I got to do all sorts of fun things like that. But eventually the fun runs out. I got in a relationship down in South Florida when I quit soccer. I was with this girl for some while, and I can tell you, our disease makes us do some crazy things. It makes us lie. It makes us steal. It makes us... it's just terrible. And she was also very sick. And I say this because it was really one of the lowest points I've been at in my life. And we were doing other things as well. But we were just living a very reckless lifestyle and very dark. And we would... One disease is bad enough, but her and I working together with two diseases was absolutely unbelievable. It had our families worried. It had my family, our families talking. You know, all these things, I mean... were terrible. Our neighbors knew. They would come in and they would... This one woman came in and actually did all of our laundry. I was wearing dirty underwear. Like, this was the type of thing I couldn't even do it. I hate admitting that, but it's the truth. And everyone else can see this stuff, and I don't know how to get out of it. And neither did she. you know, at this point. Now, I remember my family came, and they knocked on my door, and they lived in Virginia at the time, just to see them at the door. There was like a whole SWAT team of them, my family, like her family. I was like, what? So I start crying because I knew they were there to help. And, you know, without a solution, I will do that forever. You know, they were able to kind of get me out of an environmental situation away from her, and that, you know, we just both needed to be away. And I was okay for a few weeks, and I was able to get it together, kind of. And I went out job searching. I landed a pretty good job. I got a job as a flight attendant, and I felt good about myself because coming from where I was, I got this on my own. It was something I went out and searched for. I did the work. I, you know, the process of interviewing, all that feels good to a drunk, you know. And I thought this was it. I remember calling my mom my first trip. I was like, Mom, things are going to change. You know, this is good. I really like it. And, you know, several weeks after that, I'm drinking by myself in my hotel room, you know. And being a flight attendant, let me tell you, it's certainly a lifestyle for an alcoholic. You make your own schedule. I work like 10 days a month. All you do is you fly a few places, you land, and the rest of the people, let me tell you, they drink. It may not be alcoholically, but that's the thing to do. Whenever you land, you kind of go out and decorate the town and make yourself known, and then you get the hell out of there, you know. And I had a lot of fun, and there'd be points in the night where people would see me being this guy that's kind of fun to, like, okay, he's getting reckless. And I could see people step back. And by the end of the night, I'd be by myself. You guys go, I'll be fine. I can't tell you how many times that happened, you know. And then they'd be like, yeah, we were concerned about you last night. And I'm like, well, I'm fine. Again, telling myself, I wasn't even that bad. What do you got? You guys are a bunch of rookies, you know. And really, they're right all along. They can see what I can't see, that I was in pretty bad shape. Alcoholism was still taken from me at the time. There was a lot of things I didn't get to do. You know, people would be sharing pictures the next day on the flight of what they did. And this one time, I remember they were showing pictures on the jump seat of things they did that night in the city. And I had lost my pants, my uniform. So I'm sitting there on the jump seat in like a pair of khakis, totally looking out of place. Like, where the hell did these things? I have no idea where they went, you know. And they're looking at me, and they're looking at pictures, and there's cool things they did. And I'm sitting here in the jump seat like, dude, what do you got to prove? You lost your pants. You don't have any pictures. You know what I mean? And those are the type of things I missed out on. I got locked out of my room naked with behind vending machines and waiting for people to let me in. Like, the stories that happened being a flight attendant are just out of control. This one time, my girlfriend wants me to tell me this. When I was flying, I was really hungover one time, and I had been drinking for a few days, and I lost my bowel movement. I pooped on myself on the plane in the uniform. So here I am in the lavatory, flushing my underwear down the whoosh, spraying cologne on, you know, and this is where I'm at. And I'm like, I never once think that I probably need to stop drinking. The girl has to sit next to me on the jump seat. Let's face it, there's not room. We're both like embrace position. She's like, what's that smell? And I have like a half a bottle of Chrome on. I'm in the lavatory like hosing down, you know. And it never crosses my mind that's okay, you know. And I remember I used to cry in my room a lot. I was one of those criers. And I used to stand in front of the mirror, you know, whenever I drink. And I'd get sad at certain points. And I would stand in front of the mirror and I'd cry. And I don't know what that was, and I remember always drinking myself out of it, just taking shots or whatever. And it talks about in To the Wise, it talks about the alcoholic wanting to want to stop. And when I read that one time in a big book study, I was like, holy cow, it brought me straight back to those times when I used to do that. And I think that was it. You know, the wanting to want to stop, it's a big deal for us to make it to these rooms. It's huge. Think of how many people are out there and actually probably done the Hyde Park 500 around here that never even walked in the door. You know, and I got a chance to come here, and I can tell you, it really had nothing to do with me. I got a couple of DUI charges. My first one, this was good. I got pulled over in Brandon right next to our place, right next to an AA house, pretty ironic. And they pulled me over, and I have a bunch of minis. I used to steal the minis off the planes, the little liquor things. Those things were great. So, like, my whole bag's filled with minis. So they search in my car. I'm hammered. I know I'm done for, you know. So they start lining up all my minis on the back of the hood, I guess, to get them on camera, you know. So they're lining them up while we're waiting for the one guy to do the eye test, because he's a certified guy that does that. They're bringing him out from somewhere. I'm in Valrico, so it takes a while to get people out there. And so the second guy shows up, and they're picking these minis out the ditch. And these things are, like, old and rusted. And I start throwing a fit. I was like, those are not mine. Like, and they're lining them up, and they're like, no, man, listen, it's probably not his. Like it really matters. Like, I got a whole trunk full, but those are not mine. You know, I'm making my point right now. And so basically the cop was like, listen, I don't think it's his, man. There's an A.A. house right there. What? And don't those people not drink? Like, you know what I mean? And that's what he said. I didn't think about it till afterwards. I was like, that's ridiculous. But that's what he thought there was from. So that's the perception of cops, that we drink before coming into AA. Not saying it doesn't happen, but that's what happened that night. And but my next DUI was a wreck, and this was the one that actually brought me here. Was the last time I had a drink. My drink date is different than my sobriety date. My last drink was December 26th of 2007. And I blacked out. It was the day after Christmas. My whole family's in town, and I blacked out while driving. I was drinking all morning. I didn't know this, but I later found out. And as soon as Chili's opened up, I went there and started drinking. And because it's after the holidays, people, you know, most people wait, you know. So I black out after leaving Chili's, and I hit about four cars. It wasn't good, and this was at 1 p.m. when I blacked out. And I remember coming to, there's paramedics there, and my family's on the side. And I remember looking at my dad. It's kind of like if you take a picture in Sports Illustrated, you see like the one player, and then the rest is just like a mural or whatever. And I remember looking over and seeing my dad as he was the only person there. And I had urine all over me from when I passed out. I had blood all over me from the accident. And that was it. That was my last drink. You know, I went to jail, of course, and I made the newspaper, Bay News 9, all those things. And, you know, it hurts to see those things when you get back out, because you really do face a reality all over again. Just like sitting in jail, you have time to think and relive all that stuff. And then when you see it again, you can't help but to think about the people that love, or that, you know, they reflect on them as well, even though it has nothing to do with them. You know, it hurts those people. And they had a blog on I had made the TBO blog, whatever, and all these people. I never did look at it until actually a couple years ago. I was in a therapy session. We looked at it, so it was good. But he pulled up the blog, and he's like, you know, I was looking at this, and, you know, all these people, there's people, like, mad that were wanting to bash me and everything like that. And there was this one coach that used to coach me way back in the day, and he was in town at the time. And he was the last person who wrote on there. And he goes, you know what? He goes, I know this man. I've known him for a long time. He goes, he's a good man. He goes, not saying what he did was right, but sometimes people have issues in this world, and I hope whatever happens, he's okay. And I was like, oh my God, this was the last person to make that post. And I hadn't talked to him in 5 or 6 years. And he just happened to see me in the newspaper and wrote on that blog. And, you know, it was pretty cool to see that, because people need to tell me, when they told me that when I got to treatment, that, you know, it wasn't me that did those things. It was my disease, which is huge. We need to know those things. I mean, when I get sober, guess what? All my armor's gone. What am I left with now? Absolutely nothing. You know, and they told me things are going to be okay. It wasn't you. You know, and I needed to hear those things, because I didn't believe it. When I got sober, just like a lot of us, you know, I had a lot on my plate. The legal consequences, the loss of jobs. I love when people come in like that. Like, the dog hates them, their wife left them, you know, they got spit on the way here. I'm like, yes, I love that. Come sit next to me. Because you know what? That's a starting point. It happened to me. I lost everything, and I was able to come back and be like, what do I do? You know, I had to be broken. And for the first time in my life after that accident, I was too afraid to drink. That's an alcoholic's dream. All those years that I could never stop, or even want to stop, or even try to think about stopping, you know, God gave me this opportunity. And I went to treatment, and I was with a bunch of people in treatment. We had a good time. It's kind of like, it's just a crazy house, you know. And then the conversations we'd have were, okay, man, if we had this and 10 naked girls and we were on a beach, would you drink then? And be like, yeah. You know, but 5 minutes before, we were like, dude, I'm never drinking again, bro. I'm screwed. I got to get my life together. You know, we'd have these conversations, and the conversation after that be like, yeah, but I drink, but I come back tomorrow. You know, that's the most insane thing ever. And those conversations happened all the time. So I was in a safe place where I could actually hang out and have fun with people and really have time to process all these things before I can actually get out. You people that actually come in here and don't have some type of structure, thanks. A's a bunch of control freaks, 15 minutes, you know, but like, are you people that actually come in without treatment? That's awesome. I can't even fathom or relate to any of that, actually walking in here on your own and sitting down and actually doing this. It blows my mind, you know, but I guess that's just not my path. And Rob was there to meet me, and I started this journey when I'm one with an alcoholic. And he told me about getting kidnapped by drug smugglers in Morocco, and you all know Ron. I was like, this guy's amazing, you know? And I knew he didn't drink that way anymore. I knew that he didn't do those things anymore. And I didn't know how he did it, because I had no idea. Let's face it, I don't understand God. I never had any God in my life at all. You know, and I don't have faith that, oh, things are going to be okay, I'm sober now. Like, we don't believe that when we come in here. You know, someone has to tell me that. And it took a lot more than Rod. Let me tell you what, that support network, I didn't believe him. I'm calling the next guy and the next guy and the next guy and the next guy. And after seven people, I'll think about it. You know, that's the way I worked. And everyone's always said the same exact thing. And he taught me things to sit in the front row, to get readings, to get involved. And it was awesome. I got to go to a ton of, we went to conferences, Sober Stock. My first year of Sober Stock, I was so freaked out because I was in a halfway house. He was like, you're going. I was like, no, I'm not. You know, because I knew there'd be like more than like seven people there. I was like, I'm not going. So he came and kidnapped me from the house. And we went there, and I never met Bill before. He was my grand sponsor, and I knew Bill was like some delegate. I didn't know what that meant, but it sounded important. You know, so I was going there. I was like, okay, what am I going to do? Man, I'm freaking out. There's all these people here. And I had the time of my life. I first met Bill, and he was like, well, it's nice to see you finally got your head out your butt. The first words out of his mouth, I was like, oh, my God, he doesn't like me. You know, I'm freaking out. And it turned out to be awesome. I stayed there all day, all night, and I had a curfew at the time for multiple reasons. And I ended up getting riding home with Buddy. Buddy was like, everyone knows Buddy. Buddy, we were playing football out there. I pulled a hamstring. Stan probably remembers. Buddy's out there with one leg doing like cross routes. I couldn't believe it. No one can catch this guy. And I go back to the halfway house. I'm like, dude, you had to go next year. It's going to be amazing. There's bands. There's a guy with one leg doing cross routes out there. Like, I drove home in a van with some guy playing a guitar. Like, I was so amped up about AA. You know, and my sponsor actually got me doing those things. He made me do the uncomfortable. You know, I was going to Ikipa, I was going to Fikipa, all these things that seemed so daunting at the time, you know, I was able to do. And that's how basically I started the steps, and I finally got to meet God. And that's, if you would have asked me one thing that I've gotten out of AA in my sobriety, that's the most important thing, it would certainly be God. You know, I've got to go through mediations with God, facing those people in my wreck. I got to go through my job interviews, which is so, God, it's such a negative experience. You know, it's the worst thing ever. You go from place to place. They're like, yeah, sorry. You know you got this paper. It's 6 feet long now. You know all your records, you know. And I take that around, and I go and go, and it was just like, man, I don't know if it's ever going to happen. You know, and someone told me, like, Sean, if there's really tough times like that, he goes, I want you to do this. Ask God to come with you. And I kind of save that. You know, I pray a lot, and I do my day, and I know God's with me. But, like, certain crazy situations, when I have to go in something that I'm very fearful of, I always ask God, you know, to come with me. And it makes me feel a little bit better. And, you know, doing all this four-step with Rod and fifth-step is so deflating. It's just like doing a step one. You know, come in here. We don't come in here and do step one and be like, oh, this is amazing. You know, it's a starting point. It has to happen. It has to happen for us to get better. And so does the four step. I did that fifth step, and it was so, he had a big red ink pen. It was like one of my tests in high school. All these things that were wrong. And he was like, listen, you're scared of everything. You treat this person like crap. You owe this person this. You owe this person that. You're terrible. I was like, oh my God. You know, but God gave me an opportunity to do all those things over again, to work on my self-esteem, to be honest, to help others, to make amends, to do all those things that happened, which is great. You know, I tried doing those things right out the gates. I came out of treatment. I tried making amends to this girl that I used to fly with. I called her. Think of how crazy this sounds. She hadn't heard from me in 3 years. And I call her. I'm like, hey, listen, I just got out of treatment. I found God. Things are going good. What are you doing? You know, I haven't heard from her in 3 years. And Rob was like, no, we are not doing that. You know? So there's a time and place for everything. And I finally got a chance to actually make right to many things. And there's still things that need to be done. But, you know, I've tried to help my sponsees the same way that Rod helped me. You know, I always want to be chasing my sponsor. And to this day I am. You know, and that's the way I want it for guys that I work with and everyone else, because I need everyone. Listen, I'm nothing without AA. And I could stay here till 10 o'clock and tell you the things that I'm not with AA. I can't be honest. I don't know gratitude. I can't be with God. You know, all these things I'm not capable of without AA. I'm not capable of having a God in my life without the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and applying the principles. It's not me. There's people that go to churches all the time. They can do those sort of things. I can't do it. You know, the most tough times that I have are at my job. I'm there 11 hours a day. It's the most stressful time that I'm, you know, in my life. And there's these times where I get so thin, and it really tells me where I'm holding in AA. You know, this poor girl not too long ago came up. All she wanted was some change. You know, when she's tiptoeing to her door, and she's like, Sean, and she's this little girl. She looks like Rue off Hunger Games. She's like this little tiny thing. And I was like, I look at her, I'm like, what? You know, I didn't even say anything, but I had it written all over my face. And she's like, oh, I just need change, you know? And I was like, oh, my God, you almost killed her, you know? And that's what was going through my mind, you know? And there's days like that where I'm just terrible, and it shows exactly where I've been. And there's days where actually I can go out and help people at my work. And I always share this experience, and if you've heard it before, I'm sorry, but a couple of people recently have told me that, you know, it happened the same thing at them at their job, and it actually was helpful. I was training a new person a while back, and I hate training people because I'm so selfish. It's part of, I want to do my stuff and you just leave me alone, you know. And this poor girl, it was her first day and she's scared. It's your new job, you know what I mean? You need someone there to help you. You don't know anything, and it's my job to actually take care of her. And I had all this work to do. I was so overwhelmed, and I kept doing my work. And I left that day, and I felt like crap. And I called Rod. I was like, listen, Rod, here's the deal. I feel like hell. I don't know what's going on. He's like, well, let's review your day. So we reviewed my day, and he's like, well, you're a jerk. Okay, I get it. You know, he was able to point out all the things I did do. In fact, all the things that I didn't do. He goes, I want you to go to work tomorrow, and I want you to go to work for God. He goes, your job is to train that girl. And he goes, you better hope she comes back. I was like, oh, my God. I felt so bad. I was like, please hope she comes back. And sure enough, she came back that day. And, you know, nothing got done that day prior when I had all this work to do at my desk because I was real busy trying to help her. And I helped that girl the entire day. And I went back to do my work at the end of the day, and there was nothing to be done. You know, it was all in my head. I was so wrapped up in everything that I had to do for me that it was false. You know, it's that self-propulsion that it talks about in the big book. And that girl actually left not too long after that. But I got an email from her like 6 months later. She goes, you know, I want to thank you for helping me. I worked with a lot of people, but you were very helpful there in many ways. It's like, holy cow. You know, if I didn't have AA, I wouldn't do those things. That's huge, you know. And that just is the most place that I have that I can actually help others, is from what I understand. I'm there most of the time, and it's challenging because my ego gets in the way. I got a boss that I want to look good for. I got people that I manage that I want to do the right thing. And it's hard when you're not spiritually fit. I can have rough days, and what if I drink? You know, what if I get so angry that I can't handle it, and I haven't been to an AA meeting in several weeks, or haven't been reading, or whatever it is? Because let me tell you what, I go through those things where I'm inconsistent. You know, it talks about the mental blank spots in the book. That terrifies me. I hate that. It's so true. What if that happens? You know, and there's plenty of times that I don't go to many meetings as I should. I don't read like I should. I started reading, though. I tried. I couldn't find my... I was trying to find Serpent on the Mount. I couldn't find it in the house the other day. So I was asking Amanda. I was like, where is it? She's like, it's in the closet. So I'm looking in the closet, and I can't find it. I'm like, where's this damn thing at? So I come back. I'm like, honey, where is it? She's like, oh, it's in a bag in the closet. So I go back. I'm looking in the closet. There's several bags in there. I'm looking through the bags. I don't find the daggone book. I was like, honey. I was like, where is the book? I'm looking for a spiritual book, mind you. I'm about to kill her. I'm like, get up. Do something spiritual. Help me. I cannot find the book. You know what I mean? This household needs the book. And she never did help me. I'm going to put her on blast now because she can't do anything either. But so I, like a good alcoholic, I gave up looking for the book and found another one. But I don't do this perfectly, and I need a lot of people in my life to make this happen. You know, my sponsor does not keep me sober. My sponsees do not keep me sober. My home group does not keep me sober. I need every single one of those things to stay sober. But, you know, I need all those things to stay connected to God. And sometimes it takes a little bit of pain. Sometimes it takes a little bit of discomfort. And normally things fall into place. If I can get honest with myself and tell someone else, which is so hard to do, and that's why I have to have these people. I can't tell you how many times I have a sponsee that says, hey, listen, Sean, you know, here's the deal. I'm struggling with this. I'm like, oh, my God. I've been struggling with that for a week. And this guy comes up and tells me, you know. Or someone newcomer comes into a meeting and says, hey, listen, I've done this and I don't know what to do. It's like, oh, my God, I've done that for 2 weeks straight. New guy's coming in here doing this. What are you talking? You know, if I don't go to that meeting, I don't see that. You know, if I don't have a sponsee, I don't have someone helping me with that. If I don't have a sponsor, who do I go to? You know, those are all things that are so important, and I guess that's what makes it a WE program, but this is a wonderful group. I got a lot of wonderful friends today. My life is second to none. It's so simple. The little things that we have that are the things that I never had, And, you know, if you ask me what you want when you get sober, I would ask you to get rid of all the legal things. And guess what? Those are all gone. You know, the next thing I would ask you is, hey, you know what? I really want a job. And I've been promoted three times since I got sober. And I don't say that to gloat or anything. I mean, that shows what's happened. That's where I came from. You know, I had no license. I drove my bike from my halfway house to my work in a suit for several years, which was the worst. I was soaking wet, summertime, you know, and people were driving by like, loser! You know what I mean? And I'd be like, yeah, you're a loser. You know? And some days, like, that was it. That was the time that I had with God. You know, it had to happen. And today, you know, I still have a hardship license, but I'm not driving the consequence. We call it the consequence, my bike. But, you know, with the help of God and AA, man, my life is second to none. I got a sponsee now. He's so excited. He's like, I got a girlfriend. I got this new place. I'm living a job. I'm going back to school. Kid's living the dream. You know, he loves it. I love it. So thank you all for my sobriety, and thank you for letting me speak.